Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On the first part of the show, we speak to Jesse Friest, an independent journalist from the Real News Network. Jesse gives us on-the-ground coverage of the Arizona immigration debate. He speaks about the recent injunction against Bill 1070, which contains the broadest and strictest anti-illegal immigration measures in decades. He also points to how opportunist politicians like Governor Jan Brewer have used this bill to focus the public anger downwards instead of upwards where it belongs. Continuing along the same lines, on the second part of the show, we speak to Paul Street, author and journalist for the Black Agenda Report. He speaks about contemporary race issues, reparations, racial stratification, and the modern-day prison system in the U.S. We finish the show with a talk about water as a human right and the recent victory in the U.N. Declaring water a human right and the rationale for fighting back against bottled water. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to have a journalist who looks not only at the current mainstream stories of immigration, of the economic downturn, but what's behind that story. We're very privileged to have Jesse Friest. He's a journalist for The Real News. Thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Sylvia.
Now, Jesse, you've recently did a video for The Real News titled Illegal Invasion or Economic Scapegoat. Describe your video, which I'm about to play for our audience.
Yeah, I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona right now. But one of the things that really struck me when I got here was exactly how different the information was that the two sides of this immigration debate are operating on, and really trying to get to the bottom of that. So that's sort of what this video is taking up some of the main themes of the debate and looking at exactly how different just the information itself, the facts, are viewed. It's not just a difference of vision for a society or a difference of opinion. It's also the facts that people are operating on. And so that's sort of what this video takes on.
I'm going to play the video and then we'll discuss it a little bit afterwards, okay?
Sounds good.
The Real News Network in Phoenix, outside of Arizona's State Capitol building, where opponents of a controversial immigration law known as SB 1070 have gathered to celebrate a temporary injunction that will stop the law from going into effect. But the message of people who have gathered here is very simple. This isn't over.
It's a victory, but it's a temporary victory, meaning that only part of 1070 has been enjoined. It's up to a higher court now whether or not they're going to stop 1070 or those provisions that have been enjoined or whether it's going to continue. Our belief is that we have to continue to put pressure on it. The reason this happened is because of the pressure that we've been putting on the government to stop 1070.
Supporters of the law are equally determined to forge ahead.
And they're celebrating their victory, but it's not going to last long because when it gets to the Supreme Court, that's where we'll win.
You don't have to be in Arizona very long to realize that the two sides of this debate are operating on vastly different information. Beginning with the most basic of questions, like, would the undocumented prefer to have legal status?
The ones who are citizens are the ones that love this country and want to assimilate and be proud of America. But these people fight you to the end.
They're asking for citizenship. They're asking to be part.
Some of them have been here for 15, 20 years and never got their citizenship. And I have a lot of Mexican friends, and they're all citizens, and they're all highly intelligent. And they became citizens when they came over here.
One of the demands is for legalization. I mean, I'm sure if you ask most of the people here, they would love to be citizens.
No, they don't. Or they would have gone and been citizens.
Just minutes earlier, I had met Alejandra Valenzuela, who told me that she would like nothing more than citizenship in the country that she calls home.
Years old, my dad passed away from cancer, and he was the only provider for my family, so we had to come to the United States. I was 7 years old. I started elementary, and I learned the language by the fifth grade. I've been here in the United States. I care for this country. I have learned to love the people in this country, their culture, and it seems like everything was going well until I found out I was undocumented. High school year, couldn't fill out my FAFSA, had a 4.0 GPA, was doing great, involved in my community clubs, And then they tell me I can't go to college because I don't have enough money and I can't get money from the government.
The idea that undocumented immigrants willingly avoid getting citizenship is extremely widespread. Carlos Alvarez of the Phoenix chapter of the Answer Coalition attributes it to ignorance.
The answer is that people did have to come here illegally. I think all those people that said that never had to cross the border, meaning that they never had to run away from the poverty. They never had to run away from wars. They never had to run away from right-wing despots that the U.S. has imposed on other countries. When we're talking about immigration, we're talking also about U.S. foreign policy.
On Tuesday evening, I caught a meeting of the Sun City Tea Party as it was adjourning. I spoke to the founder of the Cave Creek Patriots Tea Party posse, Judy Helsher.
My husband and I are currently unemployed, and I have always looked for work that, quote-unquote, they say that only illegal immigrants will do. I'm a seamstress. They came here to get the jobs and to depress the wages. And it's not right that the wages are being depressed for the American citizens. They should be paid a fair wage.
I asked whether or not legalization could solve this problem by bringing migrant workers under labor protection laws so they could demand fair wages.
Real unemployment is at 18% here, and it's growing. That's the real unemployment figures. So that's not going to benefit my family, other people's families, if we grant the amnesty to have to compete for that many few jobs and that many more millions and millions of people for those very few jobs. We need to take care of our own American citizens first and not the rest of the world's third world citizens.
Monica Ruiz traveled from New York City to protest SB 1070. She says that the job argument is being used to scapegoat immigrants across the country.
And you can see it in the hysteria that they've created around the country, where even liberals think, well, we really have an immigration problem. And we want to say to them, we don't have an immigration problem. This country has had immigrants coming in for centuries. This is the way it is. The only reason this is an issue today, the only reason this is an issue today is that there is a downturn in the economy and somebody has to be blamed. Someone has to pay, except for the people who should really pay. It's easier to direct the attention of the vast majority of middle class people who are losing more than anybody else right now. You know, it's easy to direct their hatred and their anger and their attention toward, you know, the ones who have the least, rather than making sure that they're actually looking up and not down.
Further confusing the debate are disagreements over the connection between immigration and crime.
We just simply cannot afford illegal immigration. We're suffering from the crime wave, the drugs that are coming across, murders, rapes, there's kidnappings, and all because the federal government refuses to control the border, refuses to enforce the law. So the people of Arizona were finally fed up and say, no, we're going to enforce the law if the federal government won't enforce it.
It's clear that Mexico-based drug cartels are operating in Arizona. After all, the U.S. is their primary market. And these activities occasionally result in violent attacks on the Arizona side of the border. But according to the Department of Justice, violent crime in Arizona has dropped by 23% over the last 10 years. During that same period, the Department of Homeland Security estimates that Arizona's population of undocumented immigrants has doubled.
It's a lie that says that most undocumented workers are criminals, that they're terrorists, that they're drug dealers. Those are blatant lies. Most undocumented workers are workers. They are people that come to this country that produce a whole lot of riches for this country and see very little of the benefits.
For opponents of SB 1070, who feel the increasing criminalization of immigrants is based largely on misinformation, a climate of hate has taken hold. Phoenix resident Raymond Nowakowski is reminded of his 1957 mission with the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division to escort the Little Rock 9 to class.
President Eisenhower selected our group to go to Little Rock, Arkansas, where the Governor Forbes was having his National Guard guarding Central High School and promising the people of Arkansas that it will never be integrated. And we replaced them in front of the high school and escorted the Little Rock 9 into Central High School. There was a hatred against a certain class of people back then. And I see that hatred being built up now.
despite the injunction on SB 1070. As this video is published, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has launched another one of his famous immigration raids, while also arresting dozens of SB 1070 opponents while they were protesting outside his office.
That was the reporting by Jesse Freestone from the Real News. And one of the key points in that discussion was how the immigrants are always the scapegoat for any problems in society, whether it's crime, whether it's unemployment. How do we change this without looking at the racism that seems to be prevalent throughout our society and throughout all our institutions in society?
I can tell you a little bit about what I've learned about how it operates in Arizona. One thing that's interesting about Arizona, the Brookings Institute actually did a study and found that Arizona has the United States' largest, what they call, cultural generational gap. That is that over 80% of seniors in Arizona are non-Hispanic white, according to the U.S. Census. Only 40% of 18 and under in Arizona are non-Hispanic white. That means you've got a 40% gap, or a more than 40% gap, which is the largest in the country. So you have a generational gap, which always provides problems of understanding and misunderstanding and ignorance. And then you, on top of that, have a cultural gap, which provides the same problems throughout history. And so, you know, not to excuse any of the bigotry that I'm running into here, but in terms of trying to understand it, I think this is a really fundamental statistic. And for politicians, who are really, really at the forefront of this in the public relations aspect, for them, it makes a very easy demographic to target for votes and avoid the really tough questions that might bring their funders into the picture. That being, you know, the large corporations, the large banks that bankroll their campaigns. When we talk about the Arizona economy, you know, Judy Helscher, the Tea Party spokesperson, she's right. Real unemployment here is almost 20%. You know, you see businesses closed up all over the place. This was, you know, one of the major housing boom areas, which also coincidentally provided the magnet, the attraction for workers coming from Mexico to come work in the construction boom here. And that's now done, and the housing prices have cut in half. Mortgages have gone through the roof. Many people have left the state, and it's really created an economic problem here. And so, instead of getting to the root of that, what I would believe would be the root of that, some of the more systemic economic issues, it's been a lot easier for politicians here to target the undocumented immigrant population. The steps that they've taken to do so, it's actually called attrition through enforcement. They're very open about this, that the goal is to strike an incredible amount of fear into the population that's already in Arizona as a means of trying to deter people from entering the state in the first place. And by all accounts, it's working. One report in the Phoenix New Times says that 100,000 immigrants have left, documented and undocumented, have left Phoenix in the past year alone. I was in one community here, Guadalupe, which is about half Yaqui, Indian, half Latino neighborhood here in the Phoenix area, and was in their public square where they used to have 40 business outlets in that had businesses open and often had, you know, ferias, like festivals inside this public square. And apparently those festivals have ended and there was only 7 businesses left open out of the 40. And that had happened all within a couple of years of this enforcement campaign that's been on. Like I said, that's been running in parallel with the economic crisis. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting that a filmmaker here, Oscar León from Ecuador, pointed out to me is how when he speaks to the Tea Party, this almost entirely elderly white movement, here, that he's reminded in many ways of anti-globalization struggles in his home in Ecuador. The response, shut down the borders, protect jobs, keep wages up, you know, these sorts of problems that they're facing are very similar to what he said, you know, they were facing in Ecuador with the debt crisis and with, you know, various, you know, liberalization, economic liberalization campaigns that were going on. And he said that the difference here is that in Ecuador, people had enough control of their media and their message that they were able to point that anger up. You know, like Monica Ruiz says in the video, that in this country, it's very easy to point people's hatred and anger down. the people with the least in the society. And he was talking about the only difference between Ecuador and Arizona is that the middle class in Ecuador pointed their anger up and overthrew three presidents in the span of a year, eventually ending up in the coming to power of Rafael Correa, who has reversed a lot of these policies that created the anger and started the move towards this systemic change that you raised in your question. Whereas here in Arizona, we're seeing that middle-class white population almost uniformly, if you look at the polling data and match that up with the demographics data, almost uniformly directing all that energy at the immigrant population.
But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this attrition process, because when you involve the law, immediately images of imprisonment come to mind. And with the U.S. largely private prison system now, this seems to me like a wonderful generation of opportunities for that particular industry. How has the imprisonment of illegal migrants created growth for the prison system in the U.S.?
That's a very good point. And actually, the campaign manager for Governor Jan Brewer, who's the one who signed SB 1070 into law originally, her campaign manager is the ongoing public relations organizer for a corporation called CCA. CCA owns six prisons in Arizona, three of which deal with immigration-related detentions. I spoke to one of the journalists who discovered this, and he said that he doesn't feel like this is the motivational factor for things like SB 1070. He believes that that has to do with the inherent nativism in the white population of Arizona, and that it's being mobilized for electoral purposes, the things that we talked about last time. But it certainly is coming along with it, and it sort of behooves any of us analyzing the situation to determine exactly the role that those sort of connections and monetary incentives are playing in this thing. But it's certainly there. In terms of the imprisonment of migrants here, the Sheriff Joe Arpaio has become kind of a national figurehead, a hero to those who believe that so-called illegal immigration is a source of many of the problems the U.S. is facing right now. You know, an anti-hero, a villain to those more defending the human rights of the migrant population. He has started a campaign, a couple of years ago of outdoor tent city jails. He allows cameras in. It's very widespread. All this, these images of these people living in a tent in heat that gets up to 115 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, roughly 50 degrees Celsius. Out in the desert, some of the people I spoke to that have been in the tent city said that when they talk to inmates in there, it's actually not even the heat that bothers them the most. It's actually the cold in the winter, because in the desert also the temperature drops, and it almost gets down to freezing sometimes. It gets down to about 40 degrees Fahrenheit in the months of January and February. And these people, are having to live in under these conditions, many of which for nothing more than not having documents, for a period of time, or other immigration-related offenses. This has become part of the campaign of what we talked about, attrition through enforcement. Part of that is using all means possible to conjure up the fear. And they're very open about this. The Sheriff Joe Arpaio, he's very open about the fact that creating that fear is the policy. It's not an externality. It's not a consequence. It's not a symptom that he wishes wasn't there, but that is just has to go along with this. I mean, he seeks out the camera spotlight. He seeks out the invective language that strikes the fear into the community. It brings in the broader Latino population or anybody with brown skin into the equation because they're forced to carry papers. They face the potential or likelihood of being stopped and treated as really guilty until proven innocent. This is part of the fear moving beyond the migrant population that we're seeing here.
The criminalization on the base of skin color seems to me a return to the pre-civil rights movement, a return to segregation, a return to this racialized society where, by virtue of your color, you are the victim of oppression. You can be the subject of incarceration or interrogation, intimidation. But I want to talk a little bit about the root cause. Why are immigrants coming here and leaving Mexico? Is it because the weather is so much different? Is it because... So let's talk a little bit about the real economic causes that displace people and the relationship of imperialism throughout the region that brings immigrants from Mexico, from Central America.
Yeah, I mean, my experience is more in Central America, and most of the migrant population in Arizona is from Mexico. And it's a little bit of a different historical situation there and current situation in terms of what are the factors, as I understand them, that have forced people to come here. For example, Mexico has a lot longer history of free trade with the United States. And in 1994, when NAFTA went into the North American Free Trade Agreement, went into effect, Mexico was actually a net exporter of corn. In fact, Mexico, Chiapas, southern Mexico, being the birthplace of corn, being where the product itself first grew on this earth. And, you know, 16 years later now, Mexico is a net importer of corn. Most of that corn coming from the United States, highly subsidized corn, itself a violation of the World Trade Organization's agreements on fair subsidies. The U.S. has really taken over the corn market in Mexico. Corn used to be grown on things called ejidos, which were one of the big victories of the Mexican Constitution, 1917, Zapata, and Pancho Villa, and the things that these people fought for, being communally held lands that could be self-sustaining and produce corn and sell corn enough to meet their needs. And then what we saw with the flooding of cheaper corn coming from the United States is that, and with actually the breaking apart through NAFTA, essentially the making illegal of the ejido system, this great victory of the Mexican Constitution, that people who had previously been able to sustain themselves by keeping small farms no longer were able to. And a lot of the migration, from the experts I've spoken to here in Arizona, a lot of the Mexican migrants here have come from small ejido-based communities in Mexico, have come up here. Another group of people who've come up here were small merchants. If you go to Mexico, if you go to any of the big cities, one thing you're struck by is really how similar, especially in the north, Mexico is to the United States in terms of how many big box stores have taken hold. Walmart, Super Gigante, you know, stores like this are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And they've, once again, priced out the small merchants who can't buy goods on the same scale, that don't have the same economies of scale to offer to people. So at the same time, driving wages down, so people need to look for cheaper options. Those options are found in these big box stores that can import by the thousands and millions of products and sell at a lower price as a result. And it drives the small merchants out as well. So you have a lot of small merchants that have come here. You know, these are the reasons. I don't want to pretend to know all the reasons that people come. I'm sure everybody's story is different. But these are some of the more systemic things that have been happening in Mexico. And then lastly, we've seen how the rise of the drug cartels in Mexico has been used to paint as criminals of the entire migrant population from Mexico that's here in Arizona, despite the fact we saw Jan Brewer, the aforementioned governor, say that the majority of Mexicans that come over the border are carrying drugs or are in some way involved in the drug cartels. The Border Patrol at Tucson, which is the major crossing now due to the way the systems of walls and enforcement that they've set up, that's where majority of people are coming through, and particularly where the drug cartels are running their operations through that area. The Tucson Border Patrol has said that only 1% of the more than 100,000 people that they've detained crossing the border, less than 1% are ever served with drug-related offenses. And so they essentially said that what Jan Brewer said was not only a lie, but one of the most insidious exaggerations of facts that we've seen out here, and there's been quite a few. And so when in reality, you know, the drug war in Mexico is just another reason for people coming that have come to avoid that violence. And from the people that I've spoken to, the analysis that makes the most sense for me is that one of the major reasons for the rise of the drug economy in Mexico is the decline of the regular economy. Drugs are a very lucrative thing, and the demand is here in the U.S. So if you're looking at root causes, the demand for drugs in the U.S., along with the use of free trade agreements and other things to bring down the traditional economy in Mexico, is another factor in people fleeing Mexico. I mean, the levels of violence in some of the north of Mexico and some of the other areas of Mexico is absolutely insane. And it's hard to believe that people wouldn't want to flee that. And actually, you talk to some of the Tea Party people, and they will willingly acknowledge that. They would say openly to you, I wouldn't want to live in Mexico.
Talk a little bit about the significance that this culture of fear has on the population and the kinds of regressive policies that come out of it as a result.
You have to dehumanize a segment of the population. You have to find some way to define them. And in this case, in the future, we might see it done by nationality, Colombian versus Venezuelan. And one of the ways that they dehumanize people in the immigration debate is by talking about immigration of people or migrants the same way that you talk about water. So you see water metaphors almost everywhere, ubiquitously across all press, left, right, everywhere. People use water metaphors, you know, the flow of immigrants spilling over the border, a flood, a wave. It's as if people have defined properties and they're not actually making decisions based on their own consequences. It's like there's a magnetism towards Arizona and the United States as the land of freedom, and any time you let up, it'll just flow in and have negative consequences. And that is probably, in terms of discourse, in terms of the way people are talking, the most dehumanizing thing of all that I've seen is the use of water metaphors. And then the natural reaction out of that is, you know, once you've accepted, you know, these ideas, and obviously, as I said, they come with a negative tone, then you will respond by supporting actions to stop that. And that's what we're seeing in the population here, is a lot of support. You know, there's a lot of celebration around the fact that some of the most pernicious aspects of SB 1070 have been temporarily stopped in injunction. But the truth is that the dynamics that gave rise to the SB 1070 legal project are still here. And the sheriff's office, who's responding to that, who is an elected official, he still has a lot of these tools. I mean, he already went on another immigration raid since SB 1070, the injunction went into place, the 17th such raid that he's done. Since his last election. I mean, this dynamic is still very much alive here, and we will see more projects in the future. There's a legal project that not many people are talking about that's coming through Arizona right now. It's a Swiss-style birth citizenship law, which will essentially say, if it passes and if it's considered constitutional, and they have a constitutional argument for it based on the 14th Amendment, that being born in the United States is not reason enough to give citizenship. And they've created this hysteria around something they call anchor babies, where people without papers can come in, have children, and then their children are citizens, and then they use that as an argument to get themselves citizenship. You know, it's all creating a kind of mass conspiracy, and they use the term invasion, and it's as if people just based on the color of their skin are immediately implicated in some sort of massive conspiracy to bring down the United States, as opposed to looking at people as individuals in their own right. And it's ironic because of the fact that a lot of the Tea Party movement and the right-wing movements often talk about individual liberty and are against collectivism and things like this, yet at the same time that they give those sorts of ideas to themselves and attribute those to themselves, they're not willing to accept the idea that people outside their borders are also individuals. We should expect these sorts of laws to continue. I mean, there's another law that was passed a few months ago banning ethnic studies, essentially banning ethnic studies, putting various limitations on school districts and school courses, that has led to the defunding of a Mexican-American studies program that was extremely popular in the Tucson school boards. So, I mean, these are just some of the laws that we're seeing. There was also another law that allows the firing of elementary school teachers for having heavy accents, despite the fact whether or not they have full control of the English language, just based on having a heavy accent, they can be fired.
At some point, we need to realize that there is a bigger issue here, and that is, how does power relations impact the kind of policies that are in place? Instead of talking about the BP spill, that story has disappeared, you know, the incredible harm that will cause to the communities along the coast, the incredible abuses by industry that not only cause harm and death to workers, but also the incredible destruction to the environment. We don't talk about those stories because we're so concentrated on, you know, demonizing a particular sector of the population. You know, what other things could we be looking at where we're not focusing on racism and exacerbating division dependent on class?
It's still amazing to me, you know, regardless of when the financial crisis first hit, there was a variety of reactions from different people, but almost none of the reactions were that nothing should happen, that the status quo should be allowed to go forward. It would have been a career killer for any commentator, journalist, politician to come out immediately with the position that, okay, nobody should be punished, no changes should be made, you know, systemic changes should be made. It would have been unthinkable to come out with that position. Yet that's what's happened. you know, there's very little going back and looking at that. As we have a new normal of lower wages, higher unemployment, this is the new normal that's taken hold, and the financial crisis that hit has been, you know, left behind. You know, one thing, you know, that was really inspiring to me in Canada that I'm also seeing here in Arizona that I hope to be able to dedicate some coverage of mine to at some point is the coming together of Indigenous sovereignty movements and migrant justice movements. The newly arrived and the original peoples of this land here in Arizona, and I was seeing it as well. It's a growing connection that's being made in Canada, and you know that's a really developing story. The breaking of the isolation of these two groups, and so, you know, there's all kinds of stories out there, and there's all kinds of. I don't mean to say that there's not journalists out there doing that work, because there are. It's really a shame that these are the kinds of stories that aren't at the forefront.
What is the cause to us to be oblivious to this dehumanization, whether it's of Latinos or of Muslims or of Black people? What is the cause of us as a humanity to be oblivious to it?
Doing my journalism, in some ways, is just a way for me to explore my own personal curiosities and try and answer these questions for myself. Really, I'm out trying to answer these questions for my own good, and I promise you that the day that I get an answer to that question, there's a few in my head right now, but the day that I arrive at a conclusion, I'll call you right away, Sylvia, and I'll tell you.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Jesse Friston. He's a journalist with The Real News. Thank you again.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Take care.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/LatinWavesMedia.